That's right.
She goes, get out of here.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for May 19th, 2011. We have a very important announcement to make. That is, it is the birthday of our committee staff. So we have to, in keeping with the spirit, and the vice chair is going to start us off today.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Beth. Happy birthday to you.
And many more.
Much.
And why are you
appreciate
so red?
I don't know.
And because I'm such a nice chair, I won't ask you to
no,
your age.
You
I said I won't because I'm such a nice. Yeah,
we're
but
the same age. Not anymore.
Yes.
Not
to now, she's now older than I am.
I make a motion. We find out how old.
Out of order.
Thank you.
I think it's also an employment violation.
So. All right. With the anyway, happy birthday, and
Thank you.
So glad you're spending it with all of us on this special day.
Yes, lovely.
So with that, in all seriousness, we have several bills that we won't be hearing today, so I want to let folks know if you are here for any of those. We are going to carry over House Bill 2130A, House Bill 2131A, and House Bill 2753A. So all of those will be carried over till next week, Tuesday, May 24th.
Could you repeat that one more time,
sure.
please?
House Bill 2130A, House Bill 2131A, and House Bill 2753. Is there an A there?
There wasn't.
No.
That's what I was getting ready to ask you.
Yes. No. No A, just 2753.
And they're carried over to next Tuesday?
Carried over till next Tuesday, May 24th. Okay. And then with that, we're going to first open up a work session on House Bill 2129A. And Beth, if you can remind us about this bill, since it's been a little while since we heard it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2129A was heard on May 10th. It would modify the process for local governments to make changes to acknowledge comprehensive plans or land use regulations, primarily with respect to notice, no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, so colleagues, if you recall, we had some questions on this that we wanted to get back to folks on. I don't recall if we had anybody testify against the bill. I do recall that the League of Women Voters, we had Peggy Lynch come in and say that we need to ultimately find a solution for Section 6. I did follow up with her on that. So I think we are ready to go on this bill, and I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2129A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator also moves House Bill 2129A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Seeing none, and also for the record, Senator Thompson is excused. With that, the motion carries. Do we have any volunteers for this? Senator Olson, you sure?
I moved it. I care.
Okay.
I lost one today. I'll get it.
Okay. Since it had 57 aye votes in the House,
that's right.
Set. So with that, House Bill 2129A carries do pass 4-0 with one excused, and Senator Olson is the carrier. We close the work session on House Bill 2129A. Rep. Clem is here. He has appeared. So we are going to start off. First bill that I will open up a public hearing is House Bill 2875A. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview on that one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2875A defines public lands as any land owned by the state of Oregon and establishes that such lands remain open for hunting unless the state agency limits hunt access for public safety, wildlife management, or any other reason determined to be in the public interest. Minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued, no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you, Beth. And Representative, you want to come up? And so for my colleagues that were here last session, this bill may look familiar because we voted on it last session. And Rep. Clem is here to tell us why we need to vote on this bill again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem, and co-chair with Rep. Jensen of the House Ag Natural Resources Committee. This bill is here in 07, too. This may be treja vu for this one.
It's the statutory soil bill.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
That's me.
I was sitting next to Representative Greenlick while that was going down. That was pleasant. Thank you. Thank you, all, everybody. So this bill, it's actually slightly different. There's one new part that I want to talk about. The issue involved here is people who are going hunting and accessibility to lands to go hunting on. And we had two different bills that we merged into one. One has to do with places that you go hunting typically, and you're something that maybe your family's been going for 50 years to the same area, and you show up one time at midnight because you drove all the way from Coos Bay, for example, in my case, all the way to Unity, and now there's a berm that's been dug up across the road, or the campground you used to go to is no longer open, and some of the roads you used to go hunting on or even driving on to get to where you're going to go camping are no longer open. So now it's midnight, you're out there, you have no idea exactly why the road got closed or why the campground got closed, and your whole hunting trip has now been completely rearranged. So you're scrambling and trying to figure out where you can, you know, where's the next campground, where are you going to park, where are we going to hunt. You haven't looked at maps, you don't know the new area. So the goal was just to try and provide some notification to people who are going to go hunting if an area that had typically been open to hunting has since been closed for some reason. Not trying to stop closures that need to be done for various reasons, but just that people in the hunting community, at least, they spend time usually in the ODF&W world when it comes to state government, and that's about it. They're not that interested probably in much of the rest of government. They like going hunting, and like my dad, and that's about all he really wants to have anything to do with any of us around here. ODF&W folks put out the synopsis every year for hunting regulations and hunting guidelines, and they have a website, and many people who hunt, they know to go to that website. The Oregon Hunters Association knows to go to that website, and they could get the word out if a whole lot of area was closed for hunting that used to be somewhere where people, Oregonians, would go hunting. So one goal of the bill is to have notification given to ODF&W by entities that have land currently open for hunting if they're going to stop doing that, so people would know, don't go there and try and go hunting anymore, at least until it reopens. So that's one part. Then the other part is the sections around what we call a no-net loss of hunting, but the goal, and it's not a mandatory thing, it just says that the ODF&W Commission, I believe, is the entity that we're tasking here. State agencies shall, to the greatest extent practicable, avoid making determinations that result in a net loss of access to hunting. Before they restrict or close access to public lands open to access and use for hunting, the agency shall notify ODF&W of the plans to restrict it. That's the part I talked about earlier. So a report would be called for by the State and Fish and Wildlife Director to have the amount in acres of public lands open and accessible for hunting that have been closed made in a report and why it was closed, and then the amount in acres of public lands that has been opened. So nothing in here is mandatory, but the goal is to have roughly a similar amount of hunting grounds open for Oregonians on an ongoing basis. And the reason for this, that you'll find if you talk to anybody who's a hunter, many people who love the sport and eat the food and have enjoyed this as part of their family and their culture for a long time are starting to not go anymore, and the numbers are declining. One reason, and one that I personally can attest to, it's the combination of increasing cost of gasoline, the fees that we've had to raise to cover the costs of the agency, and then when they go, there's not a lot of places to go anymore that are open because everything's been closed. And a lot of the private timber companies who used to allow hunting don't anymore, and they lock the gates for liability reasons. A lot of public lands in the east, particularly, you know, for various roadless areas and other kinds of reasons, they plow up the road so you can't go on them anymore. So just for various reasons, there's just not that many places to go anymore. So everybody ends up in their pickup trucks on the same, you know, two spurs up some mountain, and there's like 80 or 90 people all in this thing at 5 a.m. Everybody's got guns, and everybody wants to go hunting, and it sometimes gets sort of awkward out there. So the goal, ideally, would be to not have this get any worse and try and keep a similar amount of hunting lands. So we had some amendments come in. Unfortunately, they don't fit the relating clause, apparently. So we'll have to work on that issue in the interim, I'm thinking at this point in session. But that this would be, same problem exists in fishing, same problem exists in wildlife viewing, where we're just losing public access overall to activities that people in Oregon love to engage in a variety of categories. So the goal here, again, this bill was hunting, and there were some amendments that I'm not opposed to that have to do with fishing and other kinds of like wildlife viewing, but it's, the relating clause is relating to hunting, and so apparently those other amendments aren't allowable. So my commitment is to work with groups who are interested in those other things to try and do something in that regard before. There is one issue where I don't, you know, it's kind of a currently during hunting season, there are some areas where if there's a lot of hunting going on, they make it clear that you shouldn't be in there probably animal watching because you might, you know, get into conflict with the hunting community. So we can talk about whether that's a good practice and we want to change that or not. But that's currently the way it is during those limited seasons when there's hunting. There are some areas where you need a permit to go in and do wildlife viewing, apparently, just to avoid anybody getting shot who doesn't want to be. But most hunters don't just randomly shoot bird watchers, I can assure you, Senator Dingfelder.
We hope not.
Yes.
Okay, any questions for the representative? I think we're going to have the department come up as well.
I have one.
Mm-hmm. Senator?
What was the difficulty from years past? Do you want to get into that?
Hmm.
I've been already muddied today.
I was going to say, that's a longer discussion.
Oh, okay.
I couldn't get the votes.
Constitutional.
Over here. Yeah, it's
constitutional.
Oh, I'm just looking for the history.
Yeah.
You don't have to answer if you don't want. Obviously, it's going to.
It passed the House unanimously twice and just didn't quite make it over here in the past.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Representative. I know you're going to stick around because you've got two other bills.
Yeah.
Okay. I would like to have the Department of Fish and Wildlife come up. Mr. England, and then we have Al Elkins and Bob Salinger. Why don't we have you guys come up after ODF&W? That's okay. Or you can all come up. Bob, come on up. Okay, Ron, I don't know if you actually want to say something or you just put your name down for questions. I couldn't quite tell from the sign-up.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Ron England, Wildlife Division Administrator. We are neutral on the bill, like we are on most bills that are over here, and we've committed to work with Representative Clem and others on making it happen. He's correct. There are times there have been surprises for hunters. We don't always know about it ahead of time, and this would give, at least for the state agencies and the lands that various state agencies control, would provide some direction on them working with us to make sure that we do have that proper notification on our website. We do have a huge hunting access map that we've got on our website now that we can post on that. We're in the early stages of developing a wildlife viewing access map and places to go that we'll have up and running by this fall. So on the viewing side of things, we'll be able to put it on that also if there's places that, for whatever reason, end up people losing access to. So we're committed to working with folks on making this a workable solution.
Okay. I had a couple of questions for you, but I think I'll see if there's questions from the committee first.
I
have one. Okay,
Mr. Anglin, what would be a reason to close an area? And you said you don't know. Sometimes you don't know in advance. Why wouldn't you guys know in advance?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, one of the typical reasons, and there are exceptions in here for that, is a fire closure, that you end up with an emergency as a result of a forest fire, something like that. There's been times where the Forest Service or the BLM have done some controlled burning in the fall, and we don't necessarily know about that in advance. We'll work at the local level to try, and we do work to try and get that information. We have a way now we can get that out there. And then certainly, as Representative Clem mentioned, we don't have any control over private lands, and private landowners can close their land down for a variety of reasons. And while we work with them and try and get that information and get it out, I think there's room for improvement.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I had a couple of questions, Ron. First of all, I just want to be clear for the record. Does this bill prioritize hunting in any way over other users? Because that came up as an issue last time. I should say public over any other public users.
Chair Dingfelder, you know, certainly for a land manager, whether it's the state of Oregon, whether it's the Forest Service, BLM, they can set their own priorities in any way that they deem necessary. And I know that at least for us in some of our wildlife areas, we do have times of the year where hunting is a priority. And we do exclude other uses just to minimize conflicts from some of those hunting areas right now. And we have for however long we've had those wildlife management areas. This bill would not prevent us from doing that. We also offer viewing opportunities on virtually all of our wildlife areas, and we wouldn't change that. So it doesn't really change how we operate or do business.
Okay. And then when I was reading on the beginning of Section 2, 1 sub A, as used in this section, public lands means any land or improvements thereupon owned by the state of Oregon. So I'm just trying to understand this as far as notification. So if there was a closure of a BLM property, for instance, or any federal lands, which is about 50% of the state, you would not be, I mean, this would not require you, you have no control over federal closures, correct?
That's correct, Chair Dingfelder. We have no control over federal lands, and I don't think in talking with them that if you passed legislation that told them they had to report to the state, that they'd probably look at us and smile and say, okay.
Like a lot of other things we ask them to do. Got it. So what percentage of the public hunting lands, now, and also this would not, the way I read it, we couldn't compel somebody who has private lands that's open for hunting.
Correct.
Also. So as far as what percentage of public lands that are available to hunters are owned by the state of Oregon?
Chair Dingfelder, I couldn't give you that number off the top of my head, but I know in some places it may be substantial. Tillamook-Clatsop counties, you've got the Tillamook-Clatsop State Forest, you have the Elliott State Forest down the Coos, Sun Pass State Forest, the new one over out of Gilcrest, all within state forestry. In southeastern Oregon, there are substantial amounts of Division of State lands, lands that are out there. State parks have lands that are open to hunting. And the bill would not prevent those lands from being closed if the management agency determined that was appropriate. It's just that they would need to work with us so that it was put into our system and we had notification on our website at least 30 days prior to any of those closures going into effect. And that would give the notification capability that that I think that the representative was looking for. And we have had some planning efforts in the past from some state agencies that they don't think about the hunting aspect of things when they're moving forward with some stuff and the recreational aspect in general, and this would provide a way for us to make sure we are communicating.
Okay, and then I have one last question, and then we'll go to the other witnesses. On page 2, line 4 and 3 sub A, it says, before a state agency restricts or closes access to public lands open to access use for hunting. So I'm assuming if another agency owns the land, like parks or somebody, that's the way I read that, they have to notify you in a sufficient amount of time of the plans to restrict or close access. How do you interpret that as far as sufficient amount of time, since it doesn't give an amount of time? I thought that was a little ambiguous.
Well, originally, I'd been talking about that we had to post it, and I think it's in sub B that we're
about
supposed
30 days.
To post it.
But this is
on
for the agency
website.
To notify, the way I read that, your
so
agency.
What we would do is we would need to notify the other sister agencies that in order for us to get it on our website, you would need to provide us, you know, whether it's 35 days in advance of the rule going into effect or whatever, we would set up that timeline with them so that they had that to us in time that we could get it posted on our website.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Al?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. We appreciate your hearing this bill today. I can't add much more to what's already been said by the representative and Mr. Anglin. I would just like you to know that I think the most important part for us, obviously, is two-pronged. One, the department will report annually to the legislature about land closures, and that's important to us. It keeps that issue out in front. And the second part, and I think probably the most important part for our membership, is the notification to ODF&W from other agencies that something's going to happen soon. We have, as the representative spoke, we've had families out on excursions and not being able to get where they were supposed to be going because of land closures, and this will, we believe, help prevent that by posting it on the website. So I think those are the two most important parts for us.
Okay.
That
right,
concludes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Why don't you go ahead and then we'll take more questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingbauer and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society. First off, I want to express my thanks to Representative Clem and Al Elkins and the Oregon Hunters Association for working with us on some amendments to this bill. As you've heard, the relating clause has precluded those. I do think there are some things in there, actually, that the relating clause shouldn't preclude, but they're the more minor elements of the amendment. We don't have any problem with the notification part of this bill. We think that makes sense. Information is a good thing for folks to have when places are closed down to hunting. The part that we did have some concerns about is the second part that's been discussed. And it's not that we're reporting on hunting. It's that there are other uses out there that are also important as well. And historically, those other uses, non-hunting and fishing-related, non-traditional uses, have really, in our opinion, been treated as sort of second-class uses. When you read a lot of ODF&W plans, they talk about hunting, fishing, and other as a bird-watching organization. We're the other. That's been changing, and ODF&W, I feel, has really come a long way in recent years and really started to step up in terms of providing opportunities for folks that aren't the traditional constituencies, and so that's very much appreciated. What we were hoping to see in this bill was, on the reporting, something that would provide some balance there and would allow ODF&W to report on really the big three recreational uses, hunting, fishing, and wildlife watching, so that when it's reported, it's not just one constituency that's being reported on. And so you could really see how things are balancing out and what the challenges are across the whole use spectrum. Again, that's a problem because of the relating clause, and we appreciate Representative Clem's willingness to work with us over in the future to deal with that. So we're just going to be neutral on this bill today, and look forward to working with Representative Clem going forward, and then the Oregon Hunters as well. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Any questions? Nope. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you. Anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2875A? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2875A. We are going to open up a public hearing on, which one should we do next?
2983?
Yeah. Are you here, Representative, on 2983 as well? Okay. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2983A, and Beth, if you can provide an overview on House Bill 2983A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2983A would eliminate the fee for the renewal of in-stream water right leases except where the applicant receives compensation for the lease, or prior to the lease expiration, the applicant permanently withdraws from all beneficial use activities or transfers ownership of the pertinent property. It limits the term of the in-stream water right leases and lease renewals to 5 years with an unlimited number of renewals. There is a fiscal impact statement that was issued, no revenue impact.
Thank you. Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from here in Salem and co-chair of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. This is another, hopefully, third time as the charm bill, actually. This has been something Speaker Hannah and I have introduced together for two sessions. And the issue here is people who want to donate their water right for a period of time back in stream for water flow and fish uses. And we were looking at this, and we thought it somewhat odd that you would get charged repeatedly each year to donate your water back for public benefit. And So we thought, well, maybe we could just have the fee paid one time, so people could get it on, you know, Water Resources could get it on the books. But then, did you really have to keep charging them annually for donating their water back? Because what typically happened was people just don't do it, and then they just water to keep their water right alive, they buy a pump and they water some amount just to keep it alive, even if they don't really. Probably wouldn't otherwise. And you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to just water unnecessarily, but I know for a fact that there are people who go buy irrigation pumps just to keep a water right alive because it's got some value. So we had some consternation originally about people who might already be participating in a program where they're receiving compensation for donating their, and so this explicitly prohibits them from being eligible for this if they're getting paid from some other entity for the purposes of donating their water back. And then I believe we I'm just trying to make sure we left it the way we thought we were, where the fee can still be collected the first time and just not on an ongoing basis. That I think that's the way we left it. This went through quite a few negotiations, Speaker Hanna's not here, and he actually did the last round of it. But I believe the way we talk about it is you pay the fee, so I think it's now $250. You pay that the first time. And then on an ongoing basis, you don't have to pay it every year. And we think more people will be willing to donate their water back in stream rather than just use water unnecessarily, if that is what they're doing. Now, we did have Farm Bureau talk about a number of people who, and they're, I think, fine with these amended bill now, but they initially talked about the number of people who are waiting in line to get water, and that, you know, having people sit on their water right, doesn't help other growers, for example, who want to get it. But again, the amendments, I think, address their issue. And past experience for me has been people don't give them up. They just end up getting an irrigation pump and watering. And so I doubt it would. I frankly don't think this bill would cause delays or increases in the whole water right transfer issue. And that's basically the bill. And it's you see there's a sworn statement required that the person's not receiving conservation dollars from some other source for their donation.
And I was going to say, and Beth may know the answer to this, if somebody decides they are going to use their water or they're going to transfer it from in-stream to another part, you know, another part of their property, so I'm assuming they would have to pay the fee then.
Yeah, the intention on our end, Madam Chair, is that then they are no longer donating it, so they would have to be part of the normal Water Resources water right transfer program.
Yeah. Okay, and what was the fiscal impact on this? Because I know we have already voted on Water Resources Department's budget, and
I think
to recall there was a $10,000 hit on their budget for this.
Five to five.
Yeah, we think there's going to be like six people a year. So really, and that's six people who probably aren't even doing it right now anyway. They're just watering anyway. So, I mean, Water Resources could comment on it, but we didn't think there would be a lot of people. It would assume that they're currently paying fees to donate it, and we believe they're choosing not to because it seems ludicrous to keep paying a fee every single year just to donate your water back instead of go pay $150 for a pump and water. So would there be people who stop paying fees to the agencies where the fiscal would come from? And or if the $250 one-time setup fee was not, you know, accurately compensating them for the time to enter it into their system, and so the ongoing years was what paid them back for the setup fee. But we just increased the setup fee, I think, from $50 to $250 last session. So I think we were trying to get to cost recovery at that point already.
We do have the department here, so I may have the department come up, but we'll see if there's other questions. I think Senator Thompson had a question.
Yeah, thank
Brenda,
you.
Brenda, why don't you come up, because we may need you.
Thank you, Chair Dean Culler. Have you seen the latest amendments to this, Representative Clem?
Not since it left the House, I haven't.
Is this a real recent amendment?
Yes, it is.
I don't know what those are.
I haven't seen it.
Do we know where this came from?
I think the proponents are here that are going to speak to it.
They are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just so.
They'll be up to speak to it. Yeah. So did you want to talk about the fiscal impact a little bit, Brenda?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. For the record, Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department, and we have submitted a minimal fiscal on this bill because the original fee was left intact, and we're now only talking about the renewal fees of $100. We figure we get about 50 renewal applications per year, and so you multiply that out, it's about $5,000 a year with a start date of January 1, 2012. That results in a total for the biennium of $7,500.
Okay, and do you have any comments on other parts? Because I know there's multiple parts of this bill, so I don't know. I think the representative talked mainly about the funding part. So I thought for the, I would like you, if you could, to talk about the, let's see,
the sunset
on page 7. Lines 39 to 41, or I don't know, Representative, you want to, I'm assuming that was one of the amendments, about in-stream water right lease may not have a term of more than 5 years. So what was the reasoning for that? So your lifeline is here next to you.
Madam Chair, this language is currently in rule today. So the term, in-stream leasing term, does go for no more than 5 years, and that's currently set forth in rule. So this was just carried over into statutory language.
And I think that was the, and then the split leasing.
Yes. Let's see, there's a section.
And I'm just trying to, yes, trying to find where we are in the split. Where's the split leasing? No, it's in here. I was reading through it last.
Near the end of the bill. I can't find the section number immediately, but the second piece of this bill as amended would push out a sunset that currently exists today for our split season leasing program. And I had 2029 in my head, but I don't see it in the bill right at the moment. It would push it pretty far down the road. It was going to expire, I believe, in 2014, and that we were going to have to address in the next legislative session anyway. This is a program that has proved successful for us, and so we would have made that same request in the next legislative session.
It's hiding in here somewhere, so we'll find it. I think we have some people who are going to. So it's on. Okay, got it. So you want to say the page?
That's
page
9,
section 6. That's right. Which is the
extends it to 2021.
Right. Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about that for? Especially for the new members, since we worked on this in the past in the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the split season leasing program that the department manages is another tool that water right users can make use of. This is called split season because they use water the first part of, say, for an irrigation season, and then instead of using water for the second half of the irrigation season with another crop, they put the water in stream. That's a beneficial use under Oregon law, and so that helps protect and fulfill the terms of their water right. So that's a pretty popular program, and currently is due to sunset in 2014. This would push it out to 2021.
And is there any reason that we need a sunset on this at all in your mind? I mean, have there been any problems with this?
No, Madam Chair, not that I'm aware of. No.
Okay. So there's, in essence, three elements in this bill. Part of it's the fee, waiver, the split leasing, and then also as far as codifying what's in rule, correct?
Okay.
I just want to make sure I've got it all. Okay. All right. Questions for the department?
Yeah,
General
Olson? Yeah. If a person returns their water rights to the state, are they able to take a tax credit on their federal or state tax returns for a donation to the state?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't believe so at this time, and the reason I'm struggling a little bit is just because of the terminology, and so this placing the water back in stream as part of our in-stream leasing program is partially a service to the water right holder as well. As I mentioned before, that's putting water in stream is considered to be a beneficial use, and so it protects their water right if for some reason they weren't planning to use it for the next 5 years, whether they were fallowing land or had medical problems or whatever the reason might be. So that is putting it to a beneficial use, protecting it from forfeiture in that way, and providing a service to the water right holder. But I don't think at this point there's any kind of tax credit for that activity. No.
Follow up. The reason I ask that question is because if there was, then I would, the next question I would ask, would that be considered compensation?
Oh.
Yeah, we're going to hear from a program that does actually monetarily compensate directly.
Okay.
Yeah, and they've signed up to talk about that. Okay, any other questions? Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Dingfeller. I guess my question's to either one. So the amendment would take out the in-stream water right lease may have a term of not more than 5 years. Each renewal of the lease may have a term of not more than 5 years. This subsection does not limit the number of times the lease may be renewed. Why would the amendment take away the 5-year time period?
Madam Chair,
what does that do to this bill? 5 years seems pretty reasonable. That kind of brings it up to the statute. The kind of mirrors the statute. The forfeiture statute, right? So why wouldn't you leave that in?
Madam Chair, Senator, perhaps we would like to leave that to the proponent of the amendment.
Yeah, they haven't come up yet to talk about it, so you may want to ask them.
It's way ahead of myself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All righty.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. You might want to stick
around. Madam Chair, do I have one more bill still?
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
You may want to stick around.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, so we will ask Natasha Bellis.
The Clum Committee.
Yeah. Well, they're all from his committee. Natasha Bellis and David Pilts. They're with the Freshwater Trust, I think they're going to talk about.
So they're going to talk about it.
Got it.
All right.
So you've already heard a question, and I'm sure you have some other things you'd like to say.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Pills. I'm here from the Freshwater
Trust.
I
always say your name wrong.
It's okay. I'm going to let Natasha deliver some prepared testimony, and then I'm here to help with questions. And if I could, after her testimony, I would like to address your questions specifically, but Natasha's going to focus mostly on the split-season leasing part, and then we'll talk about the other parts. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Natasha Bellis, and I'm here today on behalf of the Freshwater Trust. In the 17 years that the Freshwater Trust has worked with Water Resources Department on in-stream leasing, we have worked on well over 350 leases and lease renewals, and our restoration partners in the Deschutes and the Klamath Basins have worked on several hundred more. We therefore have a direct stake in the outcome of House Bill 2839, and we are here today to offer our recommendations to this committee. I will make three brief points today. First, I would like to emphasize the value of split-season leasing to both Oregon landowners and Oregon streams. Second, I would like to voice our concerns to statutorily limiting the maximum in-stream lease period to 5 years. Finally, I want to express that while we do not support the fee reduction to OWRD's budget that this bill would cause, we feel the benefits to split-season leasing outweigh the small budget impact. We strongly support House Bill 2983's extension of the sunset on Oregon's split-season leasing program. Leases are a unique tool. They allow landowners to use their water right for irrigation for part of the season and for in-stream benefit during a different part of the season, as long as the uses are not concurrent. For example, a rancher can water alfalfa from April through June when river flows are high, and then protect the water in-stream from July through September when the flows drop and fish need water most. We were unsuccessful the last time we worked with the legislature to extend the split-season lease sunset because, despite the value of the tool, we simply have not done very many split-season leases. And we believe this is because the split-season leasing rule requires that participants have measuring devices installed on their diversions. And OWRD is only now beginning to expand installation of these devices across Oregon. So, for example, in 15 Mile Creek in the Hood Basin, the local water master is working to ensure that all major diversions on the creek have measuring devices installed. The Freshwater Trust is currently working in tandem with the water master there to solicit participation in a split-season leasing program, and we're seeing a lot of interest from local landowners. The same story is also unfolding on Birch Creek in the Umatilla Basin, where the local watershed council has installed 11 measuring devices. We fully expect that as diversion measurement increases in the coming years, so too will split-season leasing. We ask this committee to support this bill's extension of the sunset on this important program to give the Freshwater Trust, our restoration partners throughout Oregon, and landowners the opportunity to prove the value of split-season leasing. My final point today is to voice Freshwater Trust support of the proposed amendment to the A. Engrossed House Bill that removes the 5-year limit on in-stream lease terms. OWRD's rules currently limit individual leases to 5-year terms, and so this part of the House legislation is unnecessary and is a step in the wrong direction. In fact, the Freshwater Trust is interested in working with OWRD to change the current rules to raise the maximum in-stream lease to 10 or maybe even 15 years. We believe this would give landowners more water management options and would also cut down on OWRD's workload. In closing, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about House Bill 2983 and again urge you to support extending the sunset on split season in stream leasing, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Great, thank you. I think it would be helpful if you can talk about just a little bit of background for the committee members. We have some new committee members that may not be familiar with the type of in-stream program that you have. And there was a question from the vice chair about monetary compensation. So can you talk about that? And then I do have a question.
Well, the Freshwater Trust uses a variety of incentives to work with landowners in order to put water in stream. Two of these options are in-stream leasing and split-season leasing. And, you know, essentially we provide monetary compensation through mitigation funds to these landowners.
So this is in the form of an annual payment based on the amount of water that's being put back in stream?
It's really individual to the agreement. So depending on what the landowner prefers, it could be a one-time payment, or if it's a five-year lease, for instance, it could be an annual payment.
And just to confirm, these are voluntary agreements, correct?
Completely voluntary.
Can I ask your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If I might, I'd like to speak briefly to why we propose this amendment to get rid of the five-year cap in statute. First of all, like Natasha said and like Brenda said, it already exists in rule. We believe it's unnecessary to put it in statute. We also see in the future a need to increase the maximum term of leasing. And the reason, I'll give you a specific example why we would like to do that. You're probably familiar with the CREP programs, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Programs, and they generally have 10 or 15-year contract terms. And landowners enrolled in those programs can get additional payments if they're leasing their water in stream during that term. So if we could, when we work with landowners who've enrolled in CREP, we generally have to do a series of five-year in-stream leases, and it would be very convenient if we could just do a 10-year lease that would last the life of their CREP contract, or a 15-year lease that would last the life of their CREP contract. There's plenty of other reasons a landowner might opt for a longer in-stream lease, and we would like to have that option and have the option of doing longer-term leases without the need to continually renew the leases every 5 years.
Okay. Yeah, I'm probably going to have to follow up with the Water Resources Department on this, because my concern about putting this in statute is, say, you know, in the future, in rule, if they decide to change, obviously in statute it's much harder. And, yes, I am very familiar with the CREP program, and so I think you raised a good point, because I was concerned about making sure we're consistent. Senator Thompson, do you have a question? Or you're looking like you, yeah.
Okay. I would just, Chair Dinkler, I would just like to talk to resources again.
Okay. We'll have them come back up when we're done. Okay. Any other questions for the folks from the Freshwater Trust? Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brenda, I think we're going to have you come back up. Richard, did you want to come speak on the bill? Because you weren't signed up.
I would like to, Madam Chair, but I was not aware of any amendments.
Okay. So do you want to speak on the bill or the amendments? Why don't you go ahead, Richard?
Just became apprised of the amendments. And
can you say your name for the record, please?
Richard Kosasan, Water for Life. I think there was a basic kind of a working agreement reached in terms of give and take when the bill was on the House side. I think this detracts from that. In terms of the five-year provision, a couple of thoughts. One, the five-year lease period would mirror statutes that we currently maintain for years with respect to forfeiture of water. After a period of 5 years, if one does not use his or her water right, it sets up a rebuttable presumption that that right is subject to forfeiture. Second, as you previously heard, the five-year provision is currently contained in administrative rule. Third, if it's for a longer discussion, but long-term leases of substantial quantities of water could indeed impact junior users in a detrimental manner. And that's one of the reasons I would argue against the proposed amendments.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Hosesan? Okay, thank you. Brenda, I think Senator Olson had a, Senator Thompson had another question for you.
Chair Dinkfeld, I just wanted to get your opinion now that you're back up there on why get rid of the agreements that they worked on. Why would you be in favor of getting rid of the five-year thing like this amendment does?
Madam Chair, Senator, the department has no strong feelings one way or the other. We've been aware of the question before in terms of if there are other programs out there that provide compensation and they go for longer than 5 years, shouldn't we match these up? I think our response to that would be that you can always renew, as you mentioned before, and you can do that an indefinite amount of time. So I don't necessarily think that the five-year leasing term that's in rule is any kind of limiter to partnering with other programs.
Right, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always been in rules. I understand that it's every 5 years, just like this says.
That's correct.
And so what do you think was the main reason that the 5 years was put in this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not really sure. Like I say, we don't have any strong opinion one way or the other. That what's in rule has worked for us, and if it then appears in statute as well, we have no opinion on that.
Okay, I guess I would ask Richard what benefit is in this bill that language be left in here as opposed to not being in there.
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, if I understand your question, what's the benefit of the?
It's hard to understand my question when I really don't know what I'm trying to ask.
Okay, the chair will try to clarify.
You're absolutely right.
The chair will try to clarify.
Okay.
Because I speak Senator Thompson's
Klingon
language. Yes.
Help me out here.
I think what he's getting at is, if we've had it in rule, for how many years have we had the five-year limitation in rule, Brenda? Do you know?
I don't know off the top
when
of my head.
When that rule
Madam
was
Chair.
Adopted?
No, I don't.
Okay, so we can find that out and get that answer for you. So if we've had it in rule for, let's say, several years, why do we now need to have it in statute? I think that's what you're getting at, correct?
Yeah. Okay. Basically, the amendment takes...
It goes back to the status quo, which is what we have now, which is the five-year limitation in rule. Okay.
Okay, Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, again, I think that was part of the discussions in the House as...
So maybe we have... you know what? I'm going to ask Representative Clem to come up. Because this came out of his committee, correct?
Yes.
And we can also look in the legislative record, and we can hear the discussions over there and find out what was talked about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to identify myself for the record.
Yes, please.
Okay. For the record, Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21. So this... I wasn't even sure actually I was coming here on this bill. I didn't look at my list. This was mostly Speaker Hanna's negotiations that took place once we introduced the bill with Chair Jensen, interestingly enough. So those two negotiated for quite some time with each other, and then I was finally told that we could move the bill. I don't think this part is critical. I don't think you would have any objections to having it still remain in rule. This was not the issue that Speaker Hanna and I were interested in addressing or going after. But what took place in those negotiations between those two and other groups, I actually don't know, and we didn't talk about any of it on the record.
But the amendments were adopted, so nobody...
Not that particular topic. We talked about essentially mostly it was the fee issue, because that was the whole point.
Well,
of
we will go
interest.
Back and obviously, okay. If the amendments were adopted, there had to be some discussion, we hope.
No. No, I remember the conversation, Madam Chair. We didn't talk about that particular deal. The five-year thing was not discussed. We slammed it right through once we heard that we had approval to go
for it. Okay, so we will go ahead and look at what the legislative history, for the rule, how long that's been in rule, and we'll follow up with the department and get that information back, and we won't move it today then.
Madam Chair, it's definitely not in the interest of Speaker Hanna and I to cause problems with the bill over that thing being in there or out. We could care less. That's not our issue.
Okay.
Our issue was the fee and people being charged to do it, so then they weren't donating.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2983A? Okay, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2983A, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3572. I think this is another bill from Representative Clem's committee, and Beth will tell us again about the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3572 would change the time frame in which the owner of the Metolius Resort site may apply to the county to develop a small-scale recreational community. No fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Brian? Or, I'm sorry, Representative.
Brian's fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Brian Clem, State Representative for District 21 here in Salem. And, yeah, all three of these bills are not only out of my committee, but I'm the chief co-sponsor with somebody or another on all of them, I think. One of them just on my own. So this one has to do with last session we passed a bill called House Bill 2228, and it authorized the owners of two it was anybody who was in the Metolius area of critical concern. That happens to be two particular ownership patterns. One is Dutch Pacific, and the other is the Ponderosa Land and Cattle Company. It authorized them, if they did not want to build their resort, in the case of Ponderosa, at the site that they were authorized under the bill to do it, they could transfer their development opportunity elsewhere. So it was essentially okay, if you're not going to get to build the full size or scope of what you want to right next to the Metolius, you can build it somewhere else. And so what's happened since that occurred is the housing market tanked really badly. And so the owner of the, one of the two owners of Dutch Pacific called me and was talking with me about the time limit that was established in the bill for electing to go build their eco resort somewhere else with the housing market. They really don't think they can do it, and they didn't want to not try their concept somewhere else just because the time ran out. And I said, well, I don't want to see you not try your concept either just for that, so I would be happy to support moving the time limit out. So that's one part of the bill, is moving the time limit out. The other part is the counties that they were authorized under a far more expedited process than would normally be the law to go and build their resort in, were limited to the highest unemployment counties we had in Oregon. And that list was a rolling list that changes over time. Certain counties go up and down and up and down. Well, a few of the counties that they had been working in are right on the edge of rolling off the list of high unemployment counties. And they've been spending time, effort, and money working in these counties. So they were interested in having the list that was in place at the time the bill passed affixed. So they know the 18 counties, roughly, that they should be working in to do their resort in, because they had spent time, I think it was Lincoln and Wasco, working with some landowners and working with some folks, and then they were about to roll off the list because Lincoln and Wasco were starting to move up or down in unemployment and potentially off the list of kind of the folks, counties who are below, I think it's 110% of the median unemployment. A seasonally adjusted average unemployment rate over the preceding 10 calendar years was 110% of the statewide average. And so they asked, can you affix the counties the way we had them when this bill passed originally, and can you give us some more time to try and make this project work? So that's the two changes in here. You know, what I didn't bring was the letter from them in support of this that we had available to us in our committee, but it's a letter from Jim Keene, basically, and the Perkins Coie law firm supporting the bill, and you'll notice at the top, at the request of Jim Keene, who was the one of the owners who had the concept of the eco resort. And that was the extent of the testimony we had in our committee. It was really just me talking from the dais in a letter from them. And it ended up, for all the controversy around the Metolius, being almost no floor debate, very non-controversial bill, which was shocking, because any time I started to bring this bill up to people, once they heard the word Metolius, they glared at me and started panicking. And I said, no, I swear it's a non-controversial Metolius bill. And it, for the most part, went that way. It seems like there were a few no votes on the House floor, though.
That's just a testimony.
Like two or three, maybe.
Four.
Four.
Yes, number four. Okay, any questions for the representative on this? Nobody has signed up to testify, just so you know.
I'd just like to make one comment.
Senator Olson.
On a non-controversial bill such as Drury Soil, when this comes across, I hope it is non-controversial, because I wouldn't be willing to carry it.
Wow, you're really going for
it. I sound like a volunteer.
I know. I think so. Well,
I got to get my record back.
No, he didn't do very good on this.
I know. Are you sure, Representative Glenn, that you want to say yes?
Yeah. Yes. They crushed me.
Okay. Yeah, now you know what it feels like. Yeah.
One session, it was the Willa Kenzie soil people tanked that bill. They came in and were complaining, and somebody else.
Dueling
was a,
soils.
Yeah, it was a winery person, and they were talking about on the label, you know, what soil it is means a lot. This is not the first time that bill's gone down in flames, just so you know. Not in the Senate floor, though, usually.
Okay, on House Bill 3572, is there any questions? Okay, seeing none. And nobody else would like to testify on House Bill 3572. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3572. We will open up a work session on House Bill 3572.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3572 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 3572 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, Kirk will call the roll, please.
Aye.
Senator Gomsky?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Aye. That the motion carries, and Senator Olson has generously offered to carry this bill to the floor. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3572, and we have one more public hearing today, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2838A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2838A defines shark fin and spiny dogfish. It establishes that a person may not possess, sell, or offer for sale, trade, or distribute shark fins in this state. There is a -A6 amendment in your packet, which makes clear that there are additional exemptions to what is in the bill to cover people that have either commercial or recreational fishing licenses. We don't have the paperwork back in terms of fiscal revenue statements on the A6 amendment yet.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Witt, you want to come on up? Because I know you worked very hard on this bill. And is he going to talk about the amendment as well? Okay, and you're going to talk about the amendment as well.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 2838. This is a bill that outlaws the sale, trade, or possession of shark fins in the state of Oregon with certain exceptions. The bill with the A6 amendments grants exceptions to commercial and sports fishers with legally caught sharks consistent with existing state law, state and federal law. Our processors who also are who have a commercial fishing license and legally obtain sharks from licensed commercial fishers, and spiny dogfish. So in short, commercial and sports fishers who are licensed processors and spiny dogfish are the exemptions under this bill. Shark fins are typically obtained when a shark is caught and the fin and tail of the shark are removed, usually while the shark is still alive. What is left of the shark is usually dumped back into the ocean, with a shark left to bleed, starve, or even drown to death. And, of course, there is a high propensity for those fish then to become food for other predators in that state. This barbaric practice is driven by a lucrative market for shark fin soup, which commands prices typically in the order of $75 to $200 per bowl in major cities around the world. Now, finning is already illegal at both the state and federal levels. But there are loopholes that exist that allow for the sale, trade, and possession of shark fins, and that's the market that this bill attempts to shut down. This trade is as yet quite small in the state of Oregon, and we need to act now so that while this market is relatively small, we can prohibit it while it is still relatively painless economically and before that developed market occurs. Few of us would ever tolerate the wholesale slaughter of elk for their horns, bears for their gallbladders, or elephants for their tusks. And while, as I said earlier, state and federal law already outlaw the act of finning, Oregonians need to take the next step and remove the financial incentive behind the sale of shark fins, just as it was necessary to ban the trade of elephant ivory to protect that species. Now it is time to ban the sale, trade, and possession of shark fins to protect those species. And on that basis, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would ask for your favorable vote on House Bill 2838. Thank you for this opportunity, and I would be happy to try and answer your questions.
Thank you very much, Representative. And I want to thank you for your hard work on this bill, because it is, I do believe, it is still a problem here. I did during the interim see, and I cannot remember the name of the documentary, but it was pretty appalling.
It is.
To watch the practice, and so it certainly appreciate your work on this. Could you talk a little bit about the amendment?
Yes.
Because I just want to say for the record that the representative and I have been working on this amendment together. So if you want to talk a little bit about the Dash A6.
Yes. I don't know at what level, Madam Chair, whether it's line by line or just conceptually.
Just conceptually.
Conceptually.
Or we do have the amendment, so you don't have to speak conceptually.
I'm sorry.
Is that the amendment addresses.
Yes. It addresses, spiny dogfish, and just makes that, I think, clearer. It also addresses an exemption for licensed commercial fishers. Licensed processors who have that commercial license, and also licensed sports fishers, just simply.
Okay. Did you want to add anything on that?
No,
okay.
I
just want to make sure got it covered. And we don't have the paperwork on that amendment yet, as you might have heard.
The fiscal.
Yeah. So otherwise we would talk about that, but I think the fiscal is minimal for the original bill. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. Minimal fiscal.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any questions for the representative? Senator Thompson.
Yeah. Thanks for coming today. Oh, Chair Dingfelder, thank you. So where you mentioned that this is, it's illegal in Oregon, it's illegal in the United States to do this, but you say there's kind of a market building out there. In Oregon, do we have a market doing this? What are your concerns, and what is going on?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, yes, there has been relatively small trade in shark fins here in Oregon, and what is occurring globally, increasing number of nations are banning this trade, just as we have banned trade in elephant ivory and other animal parts. And as that occurs, there is increasingly perhaps an incentive for a black market trade to begin to develop in those places that would allow the trade, sale, distribution of shark fins. And so the effort here is to just eliminate that commercial activity as an incentive.
And we can hear from the department, and I think so. We have a lot of witnesses, I think, that are going to talk about that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative. I know
thank you
have other
it.
Committees to get to, and so as soon as we get the fiscal on this, we will let you know.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay, so we have Scott Beckstead. I'm going to just call up together Whit Sherrod. Is that right? And Sharon Harmon. And I'll come up. Scott, you want to get started? Please.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States, here to offer our full support for House Bill 2838-A. This is an important animal welfare issue for the simple fact that taking a living creature, cutting its limbs off, and tossing it back into the water to die a slow death is a terribly cruel thing to do. But just as important, this is an important wildlife conservation measure. The fact is that shark populations are crashing globally, in large part due to the unchecked demand for shark fins. This bill ensures that Oregon is not playing a part in feeding that demand. It is extremely important that the states with fisheries, including California, Washington, Oregon, and Hawaii, all take a strong stand against shark finning. Hawaii has passed a bill. The bill is currently, a similar bill is pending on the Washington governor's desk, and California is currently considering a bill. So we would urge swift passage of this very important legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chairman Dingfelder. Members of the committee, my name is Whit Sherrod. I'm a senior counsel with Oceana out of Portland. As Scott said, sharks are key components in the ecosystem, and they're highly migratory, so this is an international problem. And there's been many ways attempted to address this issue, many strategies, and ultimately folks have decided that this is one of the strategies that may help us get towards healthier oceans and protect these species. As Scott said, there is a bill pending in California that would outlaw the trade, and Governor Gregoire did sign the Washington bill last Thursday, so it has been banned in Washington. We think this is important. We think that the amendments are very, very well written. Kudos to Joe and the folks in the fishing industry, because the Oregon fishermen are not the problem, and we really wanted to make sure that taking on an international problem did not have an impact on the existing fisheries in Oregon. So that's why I think you've seen several amendments, just to make it very clear that we're not trying to curtail existing fisheries in Oregon whatsoever. I do think one important point now is that with Washington having banned the trade in California on the edge, you know, I think it's really important to get this in place here as well, because it could increase pressure on the West Coast for this illegal trade. Well, this trade, it's not illegal yet, but the trade to come through Oregon, because they would no longer be able to come through Washington or California based on the pending bill in California and the existing law in Washington. We fully support this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Sharon?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Harmon. I'm with the Oregon Humane Society, a local independent animal welfare organization. We're here in support of House Bill 2838. I think the other prior speakers have said it well. I just have to say I can't imagine a more barbaric practice than amputating fins off of live animals and pitching them overboard. Nonetheless, we understand that's already a banned practice, but this is one more step in making sure that it doesn't happen within our control. We support the bill. We understand that there are amendments that are necessary, and sometimes in life you don't always get what you want. Anyway, thank you.
All right. Did you want to make a comment on the amendment? Have you seen the amendments?
Yes, I have. Okay. Yes, I have. And I understand it's a collaborative process, and that's essential. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any questions?
I guess
Senator Thompson. Yeah.
Dingfelder for the panel. I think I heard that this is illegal in Oregon and the United States already. So, or maybe I'm missing something, but if it's already illegal. Why do we need the bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, federal and state law ban the practice of shark finning, but what is not banned is the sale, possession, and distribution of the shark fins themselves.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Thanks. Thank you.
It's closing a loophole, is what it's doing. We can have the department come up and clarify if you would like as well.
Okay. Fine with that.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Okay, Matthew Dominguez, is that right?
Dominguez.
And David Kracke. And Joe Rolater. Did you all come up?
You get them. They're illegal.
You can ask the question. Well, we could have the department come up and talk about it. Okay, whoever wants to go first, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matthew Dominguez. I live in Southwest Portland and currently attending Lewis and Clark Law School, where I'm studying in environmental and natural resource law. You have my written testimony before you, and I'll try not to repeat what has already been said. I don't have a whole lot more to add. I just really want to emphasize the two most important reasons why I feel that this bill needs to, or why I support this bill. First, from an animal welfare perspective, shark finning is a cruel and absolutely inhumane practice. Frankly, one I believe that is absolutely deplorable. And then second, from an environmental standpoint, the depletion of shark populations around the world are having catastrophic effects on the ocean ecosystems. And I believe HB 2838 addresses this issue by closing the market for shark fins here in Oregon. So for those two reasons, I urge this committee and the full Senate to swiftly pass this bill into law. Thank you.
Joe.
Chair Dankfelder, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rolater. I'm here today representing Seafood Oregon. Seafood Oregon is a nonprofit that represents the four commodity commissions that harvest are the commissions are the membership harvest fish on the ocean, and they pay part of their landings into a commodity commission to market and do other things that are necessary to make sure that we have a healthy industry. I want to make it really clear, we do not fin sharks in Oregon. We don't even have the same species that they fin in this Indian Ocean is mostly where this occurs. I've been on the ocean most of my life. I must have started deckhanded for my dad when I was 4 or 5 or something like that. I've never seen a finned shark or anybody that finned sharks. However, one of the security officers here, who used to be a game warden, told me that years ago he saw a long-eyed tuna boat come in that got blown in from offshore, and they had a whole bunch of fins on the deck and attached to the wheelhouse drying. And I assume that, as I understand it, they were sort of prevented. They didn't have the papers. They were prevented from landing. But I assume that if he had not been there and if there had been this law, then he would have been able to say, hey, look, you know, he could have arrested him or... So something good kind of
so
could
just
have come
so
from
just
that.
For clarification, so since they he wouldn't have and actually it is a retired game warden,
right.
State police, and
whom
he did come and talk to
love.
Me, right? And so it, because he had not seen them actually harvesting the shark, but they possessed them,
right?
So that's what this bill is trying to close that loophole, and that's the distinction I think that. Senator Olson was asking about.
Yes, thank you.
Thompson,
I'm glad you can speak Joe Rolater, too. I really do appreciate that. So, we've got two issues with legal harvest. First of all, sometimes when we catch fish, we catch a spiny dogfish, and they've become a fairly decent, a fairly good part of our market. We land legally about 400,000 pounds of dogfish a year. The processor takes the fish apart. They don't do anything with the fin. You don't even hardly see a fin on a dogfish. They're just this ugly little sandpaper covered animal that tries to eat your bait all the time. They sell it out in various ways and all over the world, and we as fishermen are paid for that, albeit a very small amount, but it's enough to add to our business plans. So this bill exempts dogfish sharks, so we're fine with that. The other thing that is occurring is the bottom fishing, the ground fishing in Oregon, the offshore fisheries that fish on the bottom are moving towards quota fisheries. So as a part of this federal regulation, this fishery takes place way outside Oregon waters, but we land them in Oregon. Mm-hmm. We have a federal regulation to allow things, but they now are going to require full retention. So everything that we bring up will have to be brought in. And then there's a certain percentage of the time that we have observers to make sure that we're not throwing over something that's a prohibited species or something that we don't want to catch. And all the bycatch species will be regulated by a total overall cap. And we've all worked for years as fishermen, as fish managers, to get towards here. But the glitch is that sometimes we catch sharks when we're doing other fisheries. And you got to remember, there are sharks that are babies. You know, they're born about this big. And you've also got sharks that never get bigger than about this. And they're on the bottom feeding with the fish that we're after, like Dover sole and a shrimp sometimes, very occasionally. But so we would be involved in a horrible catch-22 without the Dash 6 amendments for this bill, because we'd be required by federal law and landing law in Oregon to bring in 100% of our catch. But possession of a shark fin, and you can't have a shark without a shark fin on it. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. So basically, the Dash 6 amendments take care of this, and Seafood Oregon is neutral on this bill. But as several people have said, I've worked really hard to try to make this bill do its purpose, which I see as to eliminate the market, but at the same time not limit legal fishermen. Thank you.
Thank you. David?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Crackey. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland and here today representing Wild Aid, an international organization that is focused on reducing the demand for shark fins for endangered species parts in general. I want to first of all thank Representative Witt for his great leadership on this issue. We hosted an event up at the Oregon Zoo about a month ago. In fact, it was the evening after the House hearing on this same bill, and Representative Witt delivered one of the most passionate political speeches that I've heard in a long, long time. The event was attended by about 100 people, including many, many students. There's broad-based support for this bill among that community, especially. As we have heard, sharks are facing a global crisis. Shark finning, while it does not occur in the U.S. waters, certainly occurs in international waters. And as Madam Chair has pointed out, this is an effort to close the loophole that would allow those sharks to be finned outside of U.S. waters and then have those fins brought back into Oregon. We also believe that it's important to show unification or solidity, I suppose, throughout the entire West Coast. As we've heard, Washington has passed a similar bill. We certainly hope this bill will pass. California, we hope, also will pass. And as Rob Sinclair, the executive director of Wild Aid Canada, testified last month in front of the House committee, British Columbia is working on the same bill. We hope to be able to show a united front, basically saying shark finning is frowned upon here, and we will not allow the possession, sale, or trade in shark fins anywhere on the west coast of North America. The Monterey Bay Aquarium recently conducted a poll. Those results were released on May 6th. I've included a copy of that poll with my written materials, and so I won't go over much of it except just to say that briefly, 76% of those polled, and these were down in individuals down in California, supported a ban on the possession, sale, trade, and shark fin, and that included 70% approval on such a ban throughout the Chinese community within California. I think that speaks volumes to the broad-based support for this bill. And as we heard earlier today, while this may not be a huge economic issue right now, it certainly is time to address the issue and make sure that we close this loophole immediately. As Michael Sutton, the director of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, said, the collapse of shark populations because of overfishing is a conservation issue of global concern, and the demand for fins drives overfishing of sharks. We have an opportunity to eliminate the demand in Oregon through this law and Wild Aid, and I hope that you will support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Any questions, Senator Thompson?
Got
that right. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We just have a Department of Fish and Wildlife left to come up. Anybody else like to testify on this bill? Oh, right. Okay, great. Thanks. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm kind of between hearings here, and I thought maybe I forgot to sign up on the testimony sheet, so if I did forget, I apologize for that. Okay.
We just hailed you over to the end.
Okay, very good. I'll be very brief, and I think the earlier speakers pretty much covered the facts. Representative Witt did an excellent job, of describing this bill and what its intended effects are and what the amendment captures. We worked with Representative Witt and Senator Dingfelder on this amendment language to make sure that we weren't having any unintended consequences or unintended effects on existing fisheries. And I think it was mentioned by some of the earlier testimony that many of our trawl fisheries, these are ocean fisheries that harvest fish with a large trawl net, are moving to full retention. So all the vessels are required to retain all the fish they catch and land those catch for sorting and enumerating shoreside. So we didn't want to catch any of these fisheries in, I think as Mr. Rollator described it, as a catch-22, where we have one law that says they can't possess any shark fins, but then another set of laws saying they have to land all the fish they catch, they can't discard any. So I think these amendments do capture that those individuals. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
Thanks, Kurt. Any questions for the department? Okay. I just have one quick question as far as I'm assuming, I think I know the answer to this, but I just want to check. As far as jurisdiction of our game wardens or state police, I'm assuming that our jurisdiction is limited to the territorial sea. I mean, and then beyond that's the Coast Guard, and that's international.
Chair Dingfelder, so members of the committee, the state's territorial sea extends to 3 miles offshore. The federal exclusive economic zone extends to 200 miles offshore. So the federal law goes out to 200 miles, state law out to 3 miles. We actually have some statutes on the books where Oregon asserts authority out to 50 miles, so beyond the territorial sea. I think the real focus of this bill, though, I'm not aware of any of this type of activity that's gone on in our U.S. exclusive economic zone. Those activities are already prohibited in federal and state law. But I think that they do still occur in international waters, as was mentioned earlier. So the short answer is federal, out to 200, state, territorial C3, with some debate as to whether we have authority out beyond that.
Okay. All right, I just want a clarification about what our jurisdiction is for enforcement of this.
And our Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, our officers actually do work beyond the territorial sea. So our state police, fish and wildlife troopers, aren't just confined to inside 3 miles.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm supportive of the bill, but I just wonder, is there evidence where this has been a problem? Maybe somebody addressed this, but I know that we have the ban already in place, state and federal, but has this been a problem in Oregon?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hess, I think the short answer is no. We've not seen a problem with the act of shark finning. That is the act of vessels on the sea.
Of trading, selling, anything at this outlaw.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hess, certainly there is trade of shark fins within the state of Oregon, from largely, I think, coming from the international or perhaps other states, but largely from the international market. There's a number of restaurants in Portland. You can look it up you can Google it. There's a number of restaurants in Portland that sell shark fin soup. I believe there's a number of retail outlets that sell shark fins. So they would be impacted by this.
Yep. Thank you. And I actually did that. I went on the internet and saw it. It was very interesting.
Yeah.
Any questions? There are any other questions, I should say, for the department? Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2838A. As I mentioned, we have the amendment, but we do not have the fiscal on the amendment, so we cannot do a work session at this time on this bill. However, we will hold it over hopefully by next Tuesday, May 24th. Is that correct? We will have, if we have the paperwork, it will be posted. With that, we will, I think I already closed the public hearing on House Bill 2838A. And before we adjourn, I think, Senator Thompson, did you want to vote on the bill that you were absent for?
Yep. Madam Chair, I was going to make a motion on behalf of Senator Thompson.
Open up a work session?
Ask if we could open a work session for the purpose of reconsidering the vote that was taken on passing House Bill 2129 for the purpose of allowing Senator Thompson to cast a vote on that particular bill.
Okay. So I will reopen... I will reopen the work session on House Bill 2129A for the purposes of so Senator Thompson could vote. Senator Thompson, how would you like to vote on House Bill 2129A?
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. Aye.
Okay. So for the record, Senator Thompson votes aye. And with that, the work session is closed.
He has to carry.
Yeah. No, we already have a carrier for that. That doesn't change. And the work session on House Bill 2129A is closed. And we are adjourned until next Tuesday, May 24th. Thank you.
Swooping.